Today in Studio 360, the birth of music television.
If you got your song and your video on MTV at a certain point in the 80s, you were both the coolest, and yet you were everywhere.
The new book, I Want My MTV, looks back at one of pop culture's big inventions, the music video. Later, Sarah Jessica Parker gets real about playing Carrie Bradshaw for a dozen years.
I always say we look alike, but that's not even all the time. And that's kind of it.
And we'll hear the classic tale of the upwardly mobile single New York girl's quest for the perfect mate a century before Sex and the City.
Younger and plainer girls had been married off by the dozens, and she was 9 and 20 and still Miss Bart.
Edith Wharton's The House of Mirth. I'm Kurt Anderson. That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we'll hear all about the original single girl in the city tale, Edith Wharton's novel, The House of Mirth.
It has all the attributes of a romance. You are seduced by this notion of happiness and delight, and the end is so shattering.
But first,
T-minus 10, nine,
just over 30 eight, years ago, seven, a ragtag group six, of New York music nine, fans and TV eight, executives with almost no TV experience took a bus across the George Washington Bridge to New Jersey to celebrate the launch of a new cable channel. Why New Jersey? Well, the channel wasn't carried in New York City. But one midnight 30 years ago, MTV was born.
Ladies and gentlemen, rock and roll.
The first music video played on the new channel was Video Killed the Radio Star. But what was supposed to be a night of nothing but high fives turned out to be a bit of a nightmare.
It was a total unmitigated disaster. And we also had done stereo TV for the first time. So listening in stereo sounds fine. You listen in mono, which 99.9% of the people did, and suddenly either it wasn't there, it sounded like this. And everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. Probably one of the worst nights of my life. Everybody else is having a party and celebrating. I'm having a heart attack.
That's interview tape from one of MTV's founders, Bob Pittman. He's one of the 400 people interviewed for the new book, I Want My MTV. It's an oral history assembled by Rob Tannenbaum and Craig Marks. We know MTV as the pop culture giant of the end of the 20th century, but Craig Marks says the channel had a very precarious first couple of years.
Well, part of it was because cable itself was so new then.
1980, 1981, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, even earlier, I mean, they ran into a lot of trouble with the cable operators who controlled the distribution. And these were the people who really were the barriers to entry. You can put out all the programming you want, but if you can't get it carried in these little, towns and communities, then you're out of luck. To launch a television network with this thing that people didn't even know what they were is a kind of wacky idea. Like, what are music videos? People didn't even know what music videos were. So you're going to kind of launch a whole, back then maybe a $30 million network based on this thing that no one's really ever seen. It's counterintuitive, to say the least.
And the big tactical achievement that they did early on was the I Want My MTV campaign.
That's
that
right.
Got those local people to say, I guess we got to put it on.
It's a brilliant, one of the more brilliant advertising campaigns ever, in that it went around these gatekeepers and it roped in rock stars who, usually get a lot of money for that kind of stuff. And this was all done for nothing.
People like Mick Jagger.
Mick Jagger, Pete Townsend, the Police. I mean, what it did, it actually got people to go ahead and call their local cable operators, like Sting told you to call your local cable company and demand your MTV. And that's what people actually did.
America, demand your MTV. I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
I want my MTV.
MTV, music, television, video, music, 24 hours a day, and it's stereo.
Oh, baby, make it hurt so good.
Call your cable company and say, I want my MTV.
So, do you remember the first time you ever watched MTV?
I do. I was selling pots and pans door to door as a summer job in college. And I was in the Philadelphia area, and I went into a house and was let in the door. And they were watching television, and I saw this music video, and I was like, what the heck is this? And it was MTV, and I'd never heard of it and didn't have cable where I lived, but that's how I found it.
It sort of, among other things, brought the music business back to life, didn't it?
Sure, yeah. The music business had been suffering very badly. It was the post-disco doldrums, and disco really... it was a bubble economy for the music biz. And so that was the late 70s, early 80s, and it was in real dire straits. And also in some ways, classic rock radio, which was the dominant rock radio form, was very conservative and very staid and was very hard to get new music played. And the lifeblood of the record industry is getting new bands played. So MTV would basically play any video from anyone who was signed to a record company, as long as you were white, it turned out. And so they did. And so that's how all these new British bands, such as the Stray Cats, who sort of got their start in London, and Duran Duran. And
so everything we know as 80s music.
Right. Just was kind of a byproduct of this weird economy in the music video industry where these bands loved the kind of theatrical nature of videos, and they were really early to adapt them. And then MTV had really no choice but to play them because they had nothing else.
Yeah. Well, and then once it started working, the central genius business idea, which is to say, oh, the record industry will pay for our content and we'll make all the money.
Right. It's the greatest thing it's the internet all over again. We'll just take your content for free. MTV was like a national radio station that played a Michael Jackson song next to a Duran Duran song next to a Guns N' Roses song. And that was really hard to find. That didn't exist in radio, and I think that's pretty profound that they were able to do that.
That's interesting. So we had the free-form FM DJs of the late 60s and 70s who did a version of that. But this, you're saying, did it again, putting really unlike kinds of music side by side.
Right, exactly. And an interesting thing in the book is there's a chapter about when MTV decided to finally play a black artist in for real, which was Michael Jackson in the Billie Jean video. And they didn't really want to play it, and they deny that still to this day, but essentially they had their hand forced. CBS was going to pull all their videos. So they played the video, and it became a pretty good-sized hit, and then Beat It followed that and became a bigger hit, and then Thriller became essentially the most important video of all time, music video. And immediately MTV started playing this video all the time. So they went from, in 1 week, we're not going to play black artists to we're going to play Michael Jackson and Prince every minute of the day.
But surely they didn't say we can't play black musicians.
No, but they did. The people who founded MTV, especially from the programming end of it, were all radio people. And they thought that based on their radio experience, the only music to play for that audience was rock music. And then later on, almost the same way they played Thriller and Michael Jackson, they kind of accidentally stumbled upon playing hip hop by starting this show called Yo MTV Raps.
In 1988.
Right, which was only supposed to be on at Saturday at 2 in the morning and all of a sudden brought in all these crazy rating numbers. And then in the MTV fashion, the next thing you know, it's on every day at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
One of my producers who grew up in the Great Plains during that era said that was his godsend. That made him feel connected to culture beyond Wichita.
Yeah, absolutely. When we spoke to Jazzy Jeff, he said when MTV would play their videos, he would go home to Philadelphia for like a summer barbecue and everyone would have the same haircut that he did in the video. And there was no other way that they would know about that. That was the way that you found out if you were in L.A., what New York hip-hop was about and what it looked like and what they were wearing, which was very important.
Really? So it really was the sort of the one national venue for that subculture?
Absolutely. It was the social network of that culture. And so you can, that was the only way you can find out that there was even a scene in Houston.
I sit alone in my four-cornered room staring at candles.
When I interviewed Scarface from the Geto Boys, they were just excited because it put Houston on the map. was a national platform for hip-hop then.
At night I can't sleep, I toss and turn, candlesticks in the dark, visions of bodies being burned. Four walls just staring at a nigga, I'm paranoid sleeping with my finger on the trigger. My mother's always stressing I ain't living right, but I ain't going out without a fight. See, every time my eyes close, I start sweating and blood starts coming out my nose.
When MTV finally, despite its ongoing disinclination to play rap, people there still didn't get it. You have this MTV executive named Patti Galluzzi, who says that even her colleagues didn't quite get it. Let's listen to her.
She didn't understand what a word meant. Like in rap videos, they would call somebody a herb.
Right.
And she would go, oh, that's obviously a reference to drugs, to marijuana. And we'd go, no, Michelle, he's a nerd. If you're a herb, you're a nerd. If it was a drug reference, Michelle, it would be herb. And then there was something, I remember once she said, there's all these derogatory terms against homosexuals in this video.
Mm-hmm.
Really? What are you talking about? She says, well, he's constantly calling this guy a homie.
In that clip, I should say that Michelle, is the woman being referred to, is the head of standards and practices, the one woman standards and practices department. So in the earlier days of MTV playing hip hop, I think the artists were pretty much left alone. The budgets for rap videos were one-tenth what they were for rock videos.
What are some of the bands that maybe wouldn't have made it at all absent MTV?
I mean, in some ways, an entire genre of music, new wave, the Cars, Duran Duran, Thompson Twins, ABC, Human League, all these 1980s haircut bands, as they're called, would I'm sure would never have found an audience here because radio was never going to play them. I mean, even a U2 probably would have had a much harder time finding an audience without the support of MTV, and MTV was crazy about U2. They played them from the very beginning. And then hair metal also probably would have had, so Twisted Sister. Dee Snider in the book says, you know, we needed MTV, but MTV really needed us, talking about all the hair metal bands because they were visual. They
right.
were theatrical.
And it was all about theater, exactly. And scantily clad girls and the rest.
Yeah, and explosions. And, you know, if you think of like 70s American rock, like the Eagles, for example, the Eagles never had an MTV presence, really. And they just were kind of drab looking. You know, they wore what they wore. They wore blue jeans and shirts, and they sang songs, and they just wanted to stand there. And they were great musicians, and that's what they really cared about. I mean, they cared about girls, too, but they weren't about putting on a show. And MTV wanted – it was a visual medium. MTV wanted bands who put on shows. But those bands, you know, just became wildly successful. You know, the third tier, fourth tier hair metal bands became million sellers. The Bullet Boys, you know, bands who sounded like Motley Crue. On the other hand, there's a great, a great chapter in the book devoted to one video by Billy Squire, who was this hard rock artist. The video is called Rock Me Tonight. And it did actually ruin his career. This video killed Billy Squire's career. It was directed by Kenny Ortega, who
became a director.
Right. And it was a little bit fey. But this video had him kind of prancing in a New York City loft in silk pajamas, kind of skipping, I mean, I think literally skipping from one end of the loft to the other. But Billy Squire says, and his managers say, that this killed his career. He went from playing 12,000-seat arenas to, a month later, barely selling 4,000 tickets. Radio stopped playing him.
And when I read that, what I thought of is his base, these young white teenagers. Basically, I thought of Beavis and Butthead oh, man, Billy Squire sucks. And then, of course, MTV, now that we're talking about Beavis and Butthead, that's where they existed in the 90s, right at the end of what you call what was MTV's golden age in the mid-90s. And here you have a show of horrible caricatures of their audience slagging music videos as a program.
And doing so brilliantly.
And doing it absolutely brilliantly.
Is this Spinal Tap?
Tap is cool.
This isn't Spinal Tap. This sucks.
Yeah, this sucks.
Where'd these guys get their clothes?
They bought it at a rock and roll store at the mall.
Yeah.
Was that the last hurrah of the golden age?
Well, in some ways, it's the last hurrah. It might be the last hurrah of music videos, because MTV still thought that we can do this kind of programming, but it has to center on music. And in their case, it has to center on music videos. So that was MTV's probably last time where they thought music videos were at the center of our programming. There are plenty of artists who hated Beavis and Butthead, whose videos got significant career-boosting airplay in 1986 or 7 or 8 or 9, and then 3 years later or 4 years later, they were being reamed by Beavis and Butthead. And there's a story of Kip Winger, who is this hair metal singer, calling up a program executive at MTV saying, how could you do, at midnight, saying, how could you do this to me? They're making fun of my video. Make it, take it off now.
Shut up.
You suck.
Stop. In the name of all that which does not suck.
What, was there anything surprising that you learned in all these hundreds of interviews?
You know, in a sweet sense, what I was surprised at was how fondly almost everybody who we spoke to looks back at this era. And they all mourn this kind of last gasp of the music monoculture. And I think they miss also the kind of wild, wild west part of, which is a kind of cliche quote that runs throughout the book, you know, the music videos of making these music videos. No artist likes to make music videos. It's, you know, it's just
ridiculous.
It's also against their constitution. They have to stand around for hours and hours and hours and just wait. And they realize it's a really good art form. And the directors that we talked to also really missed the idea of coming up with an idea for a video and then in 2 weeks being able to see your little movie on television all the time. That kind of immediacy as directors, David Fincher, Michael Bay, they got their start making music videos.
Well, and speaking of that, I remember practically the moment, I guess in the 90s when people started saying about movies in theaters, oh, it's the MTV effect, oh, this quick cutting. And certainly in action movies, that's true. Do you think it's true in general? Did MTV and these 3 minute forms of quick cutting transform cinema?
I think it probably more massively impacted the quote unquote art form of television commercials, which really did become complete cops of the way that music videos look and feel. But I do think, I think Michael Bay's movies are. Big, expensive music videos where nothing has to really make sense as long as there's just something cool to look at.
And some music.
And some really loud music.
Cut to music.
Yeah.
One of the reasons it worked as this both cool, hip thing and this massive thing is because it started before there was an internet. In the digital age where everything is so fractured and everybody can go deep into their own little niche, can another equivalent cultural thing happen like MTV?
You're asking me. Probably not in the same way. But, you know, on the other hand, music videos are still the main reason why people will go to YouTube.
Really?
Yeah. But, you know, video budgets have been cut. I interviewed plenty of people in the book who are producers who worked at record labels, let's say, who are in charge of making videos. And they say the budgets now are what they were in 1982. So they've come completely full circle because there is no MTV. There's no national platform where
telling you these are the 10 you should be caring about right now.
And, you know, everyone's going to watch them at the same time. When Guns N' Roses' Welcome to the Jungle premiered on MTV, or when Smells Like Teen Spirit very famously got its legs on MTV, everything changed. You know, and that's exaggerated, and it's not as true as it seems now. But still, there's enough truth in there to make it worth saying. It's hard to imagine there's that one place now that can produce that kind of change.
Craig Marks, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Craig Marks is the co-author of the new book, I Want My MTV. So, what's your favorite music video from MTV's golden age? Mine is probably Smells Like Teen Spirit, although my guilty pleasure favorite was Robert Palmer's Addicted to Love. So tell us yours at studio360.org. Coming up, Sarah Jessica Parker is most famous for bringing the modern city girl sex life to TV. But did you know she also launched the first reality show about fine art?
I wanted to bring this idea of supporting American artists, giving them an audience, and creating an audience for art at the same time.
Sarah Jessica Parker on her Bravo show, Work of Art. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. 5 years ago on the show, we redesigned Christmas. The whole holiday and all its associated stuff. We hired the graphic designer Michael Beirut of the firm Pentagram to come up with a fresh 21st century concept.
I think Christmas is one of those brands. You have to call it a brand at this point because it sort of has superseded its origins now, and it's this all-consuming event. And if you're not a Christian, there's always a bench you might feel excluded by it. And if you are a Christian, there's indications, at least in some quarters, that you're offended when people attempt to secularize it at all. So I think the opportunity here, perhaps, is just by putting some simple guidelines around it, redesigning some of the elements of it, perhaps we could bring peace on earth, goodwill towards men in these regards, which would be very much in keeping with the spirit of the season.
And since then, we've done all kinds of redesigns of things, of the rainbow gay flag and Valentine's Day and the Monopoly game. We want to know what big thing you think we ought to redesign next. What symbol or mascot or holiday or business or, I don't know, country or whatever should we make over now? For a refresher, you can see all the past redesigns we've done at studio360.org and tell us what you'd like us to redesign next.
When I have a brand new hairdo with my eyelashes all in curl, well, I float as the clouds on air do. I enjoy being a girl.
For lots of people, Sarah Jessica Parker pretty much is Carrie Bradshaw.
Welcome to the age of uninnocence. No one has breakfast at Tiffany's and no one has affairs to remember. Instead, we have breakfast at 7 a.m. and affairs we try to forget as quickly as possible.
But 14 years after she started Sex and the City, Sarah Jessica Parker is moving on.
14 artists will be given a unique opportunity to show their talent to America and the top players in the art world.
Last year, she helped launch a new reality TV series about making fine art. Work of Art is now in its second season on Bravo. The winner of the first season, an art teacher from Pennsylvania, got an exhibit in a major New York City art museum as his prize. I asked Parker about how she dreamed up the show.
It came out of my husband's mother was a great painter, and she didn't have the sort of success that I thought that she should have had. And after she died, she was discovered by this really important, prominent gallery here in New York City, and people were really taken with her work, and I found that very heartrending, and I know that was a big source of disappointment in her life. And so I started thinking about art and where are the next exciting American artists and where are they hiding and what do they want to say.
And the show is, as I understand it, sort of in the Next Top Model Project Runway.
Yeah, I would say it's
tradition.
In the Top Chef tradition.
Uh-huh.
It's that blueprint. I have this routine when I get to go to work in London. We get off the plane and we drop our stuff off at the hotel and we go to the Tate. We just do it every single solitary time.
That's a good ritual.
And we love it. And even if we're tired, we just, you know. And I sit in the Rothko rooms, and it's not, those aren't even my favorite of his, but it's the story that he tells. I mean, from the time I was a little girl, the first time I saw Christina's World and a painting.
The Andrew Wyeth painting.
The Andrew Wyeth, and a painting told me a story. we came and we saw Guernica, and I stood there as long as my parents. And I wanted to kind of illustrate to people in this country that we all have art in our lives. You know, you save a postcard from a friend and you put it on the refrigerator. You cut out a picture from the newspaper. You save a piece of your kid's art. Or your friend doodles something during dinner and you pocket it. And we all have art in our lives. And then there's the world of art that we think is rarefied. It's for the privileged. We can't go to galleries. Museums terrify us. We don't have an art history background. That's just not true. It's in our lives every day. We respond to advertising. And so I wanted to bring this idea of supporting American artists, giving them an audience, and creating an audience for art at the same time.
And the idea is that if it works, you'll keep choosing a winner.
That's the hard part. We do choose a winner because we have to.
And you have serious art critics doing the choosing.
We have very serious art critics. And we have our artists, people who are performance artists who use materials, who use themselves. We were after sculptors. And we knew that that would challenge us for challenges because it's very different to say to all designers on Project Runway, you all have to use lettuce. Like everybody, it's
although it would be an interesting choice for artists today to say you all have to draw something because some of them couldn't.
Right. I too wanted to explore the basics and the fundamentals of a discipline so that people could see what it means to be an artist, what it is to create a straight line versus a curved line. Like, these are very scary things for me too. I think of drawing, my first response is I can't draw. You know, and I saw this great thing on Tim Burton when he had his show up at MoMA talking about how we all feel about being artists. You know, none of us have to explore it as vocation, but everybody I know, I can't draw. You got to tell a child early on, you can definitely draw. Whatever you do with it doesn't matter, but you can draw. All children can draw.
Well, speaking of the creativity that every child has within her, you had your breakout performance as a child playing Annie on Broadway.
Together at last, together forever.
Where did you find this?
We're tying a knot they never can sever. I don't need sunshine now to turn my skies to blue.
That is a very young Sarah Jessica Parker singing a song from Annie.
One of my favorites.
Was that altogether happy and wonderful, or was it scary and strange as well?
It was only wonderful. I never imagined I would be cast in that show. I went to see it. We got standing room. I'm one of eight kids, and all the older kids got to go. We all stood in the back of the Alvin Theater. It was then the Alvin Theater. It is now the Neil Simon Theater. We watched it, and my father said to me very sweetly, hoping to be helpful at the end of the show, he said, well, you know you're not Annie material. You'll never be cast in that show. And I thought he was right, and nonetheless, I auditioned, and that's how I became Annie.
Really?
Yeah.
You were 12 or something when you did that. You'd been acting for a while. Did you feel like you got your full quota of normal childhood life?
I think because I was one of eight kids, I just didn't have an option. I mean, I was still expected to load the dishwasher and take care of my younger brothers and sisters, and I still got in trouble and a lot and disappointed my parents and lied and stole and cheated.
Well, Sarah Jessica Parker, this is your life. You worked right through your teenage years. And you became this teenage heartthrob in Footloose.
Did
and
I?
You did.
Did I?
You did. Even though I was an adult throbbing my heart for you. You did Flight of the Navigator. You did the TV series Square Pegs. I want to play a clip from Square Pegs, in which your character Patty, who's this nerdy, awkward freshman.
With glasses not unlike your own. Atticus Finch glasses.
There you go.
Yeah.
This is a scene in which Patty happens to show up at a dance at the same time as this older, cooler guy she has a crush on.
Look, I don't know how to say this, but
I thought you liked me.
I do like you. It's just that I'm seeing somebody else.
Who?
You don't know her. She's in college. You're not gonna cry, are you?
Yes. I mean, no.
I never meant to make you think that.
Larry, you needn't reproach yourself. I understand perfectly. I've had some experience with this sort of thing before, you know.
Really?
So I think you're a terrific kid with a lot of potential.
Don't give it another thought. Why ask for the moon when we have the stars?
You certainly have an unusual mind for a kid your age.
I remember that scene.
I can tell you recited the line along with yourself. You, in that character and other characters, as a young actress, you played ugly ducklings.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like an ugly duckling?
I don't know that I felt like an ugly duckling. I definitely understood that I wasn't, by Hollywood standards, thought of as pretty. I was the cerebral best friend of the pretty girl, you know? And I've been counseled to do all sorts of things to myself. And while it's painful to hear them for a moment, or perhaps longer than a moment, I've never made the decision to do it.
What have you been counseled to do, for instance?
Oh, change my hair, fix my nose, pluck my eyebrows, put on weight, all sorts of things that really don't have anything to do with my natural DNA.
On a 0 to 100% scale, how much are you like Carrie Bradshaw?
30%? Yeah, at most. The things that I can point to and I know we share are our love of this city, New York City. I always say we look alike, but that's not even all the time. And that's kind of it.
It must be strange to have co-invented this thing 12, 13 years ago now and still be doing it.
It is, but it's... I love it. I love playing Carrie Bradshaw. I've never looked back. Can you imagine a double life? It's wonderful, including the last movie, including all that bleak, gray period in the middle. I keep telling someone's life. It's like the book that I loved. I read Winter's Tale for the first time while we
Mark
were making...
Mark Halpern?
Yes.
One of my favorites of all time.
Oh, my God.
If I did the fist-bumping, palm-slap, high-fiving thing, I would now be doing that with you.
I read it. I brought it to Morocco. And it took me all these years because, you know, it's so massive to carry around. And when I started reading it, I was stunned. And in a way, I felt like, well, this is as long a life as I've been doing Carrie Bradshaw. It has nothing to do with Carrie Bradshaw except this city and how he talks about the city and different times of this city and such sadness in this city and such hope. And
the literal magic and the spectacle and all of it, yeah.
And from the time I was a little girl, my father was born and raised in Brooklyn, and we used to come to New York and visit him. My parents were divorced, and we would come and spend our summers in New York. We would drive from Cincinnati, and we would cross the George Washington Bridge, and from the time that we were on the other side of the bridge, on the Jersey side, and we got through the toll, and we could start seeing the island of Manhattan, something happened in the car.
The Gershwin was cued?
Literally, we would start singing, but we would look at the island, you know, from way up north, and it was literally like poetic to us. And it was always so hard to leave. And I love Cincinnati. I think Cincinnati is a really important city, like so many cities in this country that have so much to offer and are interesting and exciting places. But I can't live anywhere else.
Sarah Jessica Parker, thank you very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure at last.
Work of Art on the Bravo Channel is in its second season.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today. I wanna be a part of it. New York, New York. It's up to you. You. You're.
Coming up. Before Sex and the City, there was another glamorous young single woman playing the field in New York City. But unlike Carrie Bradshaw, Lily Bart was really not in control of her destiny.
What happens to a woman who loses that central vein of forward motion? There's nowhere for her to go. I am devastated and I am suicidal.
The House of Mirth from our series on American icons. That's just ahead from WNYC and PRI. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Lily Bart is a smart, witty, single New Yorker and stunningly beautiful. She's at parties every night and on the prowl for a husband. But Lily is anxious. She's turning 30 and struggling to manage her money, her friendships, romance. This isn't a TV show. It's Edith Wharton's 1905 novel, The House of Mirth. The book sold 140,000 copies its first year, an enormous bestseller. And although the social world it depicted was in its final days even then, the novel feels strangely modern. In today's episode of our American Icon series, Studio 360's Michelle Siegel steps inside The House of Mirth.
So, how many times have you read the book?
Probably 20 times or more. I've read it so many times, and every time I see something different in it.
I've studied it.
I did fall in love with it because of not only the marvelous use of English, I mean, it's wonderfully written, but it is the most savage satire.
It has all the attributes of a romance. You are seduced by this notion of happiness and delight, and the end is so shattering.
The House of Mirth opens in Grand Central Station. It's where the bachelor Lawrence Selden spots Lily Bart.
Selden had never seen her more radiant. Her vivid head, relieved against the dull tints of the crowd, made her more conspicuous than in a ballroom. And under her dark hat and veil, she regained the girlish smoothness, the purity of tint that she was beginning to lose after 11 years of late hours and indefatigable dancing.
Here's what you need to know about the book. It's New York City just before the turn of the 20th century. Lily Bart is 29 years old. Her parents have died, and her family money is gone. Her beauty is beginning to fade, the very looks where her value lies. A wealthy aunt takes her in, but Lily's spending and gambling habits go far beyond her allowance. The House of Mirth chronicles Lily's quest to find a husband, and fast. For Lily, this means saying yes to every social function.
She looked down the long table, studying its occupants one by one. How dreary and trivial these people were. Lily reviewed them with a scornful impatience. Carrie Fisher with her shoulders, her eyes, her divorces. Young Silverton, who had meant to live on proofreading and write an epic, and who now lived on his friends and had become critical of truffles.
Nothing is said, nothing overtly savage happens. But below the surface, you know, I mean, you're in deadly danger from the moment you get up till the moment you go to bed. And that's what's terrifying.
Terence Davies wrote and directed the 2000 film adaptation of The House of Mirth. He took a lot of his dialogue straight from Wharton. In this scene, a friend warns Lily about the backstabbing ways of their mutual acquaintance, Bertha Dorset.
Oh, I don't say there's any real harm in Bertha, but she delights in making people miserable, especially her husband. Poor George. But she is dangerous. And you're not nasty. And for always getting what she wants in the long run, commend me to a nasty woman.
I thought you were so fond of Bertha.
Oh, I am. It's much safer to be fond of dangerous people.
The upper class here is gross and animalistic and horrendous, totally immoral.
Hildegard Huller teaches American literature at the City University of New York.
Wharton calls it the tyranny of the tea tray. You know, the minute the tea tray comes into the room, everybody has assigned roles. Certain things can no longer be said, can no longer be done. Everybody has to perform according to that tyranny.
The book had all the trappings you'd see in a novel of manners, like something from Jane Austen, but with an edge. Wharton was one of the first American novelists to write about money and class. With finance capitalism on the rise, people were getting rich quickly, not just inheriting their wealth. In The House of Mirth, old money clashed with new. It made the novel a sensation. And writer Roxana Robinson says American readers hadn't seen a tragic heroine like Lily Bart before.
Well, I would compare it to Anna Karenina. There was this notion of the upper classes, the classes of privilege. And when they were written about, they were perceived as conquerors and triumphant. So those endings were usually happy. And to have this interior view of a world that most people only saw from the outside, and to see the extraordinary pain that could be felt there, was just a revelation, I think.
Robinson first read the novel as a teenager. She had a glamorous aunt, a former model who worked at Vogue, who turned her on to the book. Robinson immediately related to the endless social rules Lily has to obey. The suffocating world depicted in the book was also Edith Wharton's reality.
She was still stuck in this circle of people who judged her on the length of her skirt and the set of her shoulders.
A woman is asked out as much for her clothes as for herself. The clothes are the background, the frame, if you like. They don't make success, but they are a part of it. Who wants a dingy woman?
Wharton was not a beauty, and she wasn't rich. So it wasn't for 6 years that she became engaged, and he wasn't a catch. Edward Wharton was 12 years older than she was. He'd never had a job. He lived with his mother, and his father was in an insane asylum. Writing saved her sanity and certainly was her greatness, but she still was held a prisoner in a marriage and a life that she couldn't escape from.
So it's not an autobiography of Wharton, but it is like an emotional autobiography of her.
Yes. She was writing in The House of Mirth about what happens to a woman who loses that central vein of forward motion. There's nowhere for her to go. So I think in that way, she's not punishing Lily. She's saying, this is what it feels like to me. I am devastated and I am suicidal.
Everything in the past seemed simple, natural, full of daylight, and she was alone in a place of darkness and pollution. Alone. It was the loneliness that frightened her.
Some modern readers might dismiss this as turn-of-the-century chick lit, but Edith Wharton wasn't just making entertainment. She took a risk in writing seriously about women's lives and emotions. Through Lily, she posed questions women and men still ask. How will we lead our lives? What will become of us? And Wharton didn't stop there. She critiqued the society she lived in. She exposed how it treated women and how it was governed by money, class, and taste.
Every couch, every pillow, every meal is about the sense of entrapment and the sense of being determined by those things. And taste is something you can't acquire, even though you can have the money, but you can't have the class because you don't have the taste.
Lily's goal is to keep her footing in the upper class, but the very notion of class that Lily aspires to, well, it was becoming nostalgic. This plays out in her relationship with Sim Rosedale. He's a successful investor and single, but he's an outsider because he's Jewish. Rosedale needs Lily to help him climb the social ladder. Early on in the novel, Lily is repulsed by him. She rejects his advances. A year passes, and she's in a much more desperate situation. She tells him she's ready to marry him. But now, he sees things differently.
Miss Lily, what I mean...
What you mean to say is that I am not as desirable a match as once you thought me.
You know as well as I do, last year you wouldn't look at me. Now you appear willing to do so. What's changed in the interval? Your situation. Then you thought you could do better.
You think you can?
Yes, I do.
I mean, all of Edith Wharton's books are about money. There's an exchange in every single encounter. It's an exchange of value.
In the 1990s, Candace Bushnell began to write about the same themes, first in her newspaper columns and then in her novel, Sex and the City.
The exchange of being seen with the right person will elevate you in society. There's always a tit for tat, and that is still very, very true in New York society. It goes on under the surface, or it's blatant.
What are you getting so uptight about?
I mean, money is power. Sex is power. Therefore, getting money for sex is simply an exchange of power.
Don't listen to the dime store Camille Paglia.
I don't know whether to take it as an incredible compliment or as an incredible insult.
Just take it, period.
Well, the Sex and the City TV series was based on Bushnell's book and starred Sarah Jessica Parker as Carrie Bradshaw.
You guys, I'm just gonna, you know, I'm gonna write the whole thing off as a bad date with a cash bonus.
Bushnell had very early on tried to kind of position herself with Wharton really as something of a kind of social commentator on this milieu of privileged New York society. They kind of move in broadly similar circles 100 years apart.
That's Deborah German. She lectures on contemporary television at Roehampton University in London.
What's interesting about both Lily and Carrie, they're both kind of really caught up in that world and seduced by that world, but they also stand outside it sometimes and criticise it and feel uncomfortable in it.
Younger and plainer girls had been married off by the dozens, and she was 9 and 20 and still Miss Bart. She was beginning to have fits of angry rebellion against fate when she longed to drop out of the race and make an independent life for herself. But what manner of life would it be?
What if Prince Charming had never showed up? Would Snow White have slept in that glass coffin forever? Or would she have, eventually, woken up, spit out the apple, gotten a job, a health care package, and a baby from her local neighborhood sperm bank? I couldn't help but wonder.
So does it surprise you that, in this respect, so little has changed? I mean, so much has changed in 100 years, but also so little?
Well, although women have clearly moved on, you know, underneath it all, there's this kind of continuing strand of the difficulty of what marriage represents for women. The difficulty of kind of gender inequity that still exists between men and women, despite the fact that women clearly have, you know, careers that they couldn't have dreamed of 100 years ago. What Wharton kind of shows is how difficult it is for women to maintain or pursue close friendships. By the time we get to Sex and the City, key difference is that, you know, women are able to kind of celebrate their friendships together.
Don't laugh at me, but maybe we could be each other's soulmates.
Well, that sounds like a plan.
Just before I started writing Sex and the City, a girlfriend and I had read House of Mirth, and we vowed that we must never end up like Lily Bart. It was kind of eye-opening that if you are kind of hoping that in some way you're going to be saved by society, you really may not be.
By the end of the book, Lily gets fired from a hatmaker's workshop. Her stitching just wasn't up to snuff. And so with very little money left, she's forced to live in a boarding house.
Her whole past was reenacting itself at 100 different points of consciousness. Where was the drug that could still this legion of insurgent nerves? She put out her hand and measured the soothing drops into a glass. But as she did so, she knew they would be powerless against the supernatural lucidity of her brain. She had long since raised the dose to its highest limit, but tonight she felt she must increase it. She knew she took a slight risk in doing so. She remembered the chemist's warning. If sleep came at all, it might be a sleep without waking.
Lily Bart doesn't wake up.
What do you do if you think you know the rules and then you don't and you're destroyed by them? But in that process, you find that you have moral integrity.
This character whom you have come to live in as yourself, you live in Lily Bart's mind.
We identify with her weakness. And most of us are quite entrapped ourselves. We want fashion. We want to be beautiful. We compromise ourselves.
And you're so hoping that she's going to find the pinnacle of the life that she's capable of. And it's so devastating to see her descend from those heights. And to realize that Wharton constructs this perfectly. There is no other ending that's possible for Lily Bart. There's nothing else.
Edith Wharton created a breakthrough novel, and The House of Mirth was her personal breakthrough, too. She was 43 years old when it was published. and it gave her success and freedom she'd never had before. And in 1920, she won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction, a first for a woman, for her novel The Age of Innocence. Towards the end of her life, Wharton wrote an autobiography. It's called A Backward Glance, and in it, she tells a story about her time as a war correspondent in France during World War I. She went to ask a French official for permission to go to a battlefield, and the official refused her, but then he went to go talk to the general, and when he returned, he says to Wharton, "Are you the author of The House of Mirth? Because if so, the general says, you can have a pass." For Studio 360, I'm Michelle Siegel.
Anne-Marie Nest read from the novel. At Studio360.org, you can see pages from the first edition of The House of Mirth and hear the novelist Jonathan Franzen talk about why it's one of his all-time favorite books. And that is it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you listen again next time. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Emma Miller,
Katie Long,
Sharon Mashihi.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum. Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion. Scion, making vehicles for today's connected youth and offering over 150 accessories to choose from. Learn more at scion.com. Scion, what moves you? And by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, David Cronenberg is known for his weird, gory movies like The Fly and Dead Ringers. His new movie about Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung is straightforward realism, but he insists it isn't a departure.
I don't really know what an archetypal Cronenberg movie is.
Oh, yes, you do.
I know what people say it is. That's not the same thing.
Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.